For more on the VA Inspector General's report and the department's response, I'm joined now by the Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Sloan Gibson. Welcome to the program.
Melissa, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Let's start with that conclusion. The report says it cannot conclusively prove that the absence of timely quality care caused the deaths of these veterans. But even so, it's quite clear that a wait time of 7-8 months for an appointment presented health and safety risks for these patients. Do you acknowledge that the conclusion here is that this shows a widespread failure of care within the VA?
Absolutely, yes. I would say, on the one hand, I'm relieved that they did not conclude that the delays caused deaths, but they're still inexcusable. We owe our veterans there and around the country, and we owe the American people an apology.
Well, apart from an apology, I want to ask you about what action might be taken,
sure.
Because this, of course, is not a new problem. The report today says that there have been 20 reports on wait times and access to care within the VA since 2005. And here's a quote from the report, "VA has been resistant to change." So why should veterans expect anything to be different now?
Well, I think what veterans should be doing is watching our actions. What you have are new leaders inside the organization. What you've got is an environment of openness and transparency that's being created. We're pushing detailed wait time information out the door twice a month, detailed care quality and patient safety information out the door. So I think what we're trying to do is to be very open and very transparent and demonstrate accountability. But at the end of the day, we have to earn that trust back.
When you think about the existing system, part of the problem has been, with these long wait times, that the VA has not had enough doctors, especially in primary care. Under the new reform bill, there is now billions of dollars to spend on private care outside the VA system. Do you see that as a long-term fix as opposed to bringing more doctors within the VA itself?
I think purchase care is designed for extraordinary demand, extraordinary technology, or extraordinary geography. But it's not intended to be a replacement for a strong and vital and effective veterans health care system. In my testimony, both to the Senate and to the House, I noted that I thought the greatest risk in the intermediate term was that funding would only be provided to provide more care, to deliver more care in the community, and not to make up for the shortfall in clinicians that you've just mentioned, as well as in space. We oftentimes, when I'm out visiting medical centers, I find that space is one of the key constraints for access to care.
When you think about benchmarks for success, you've talked about earning back the trust of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
What metrics do you use for that? I mean, when you think about the original 14-day deadline for appointments that led to this whole system of lying about wait times to meet that goal, what's your new measure of success and how do you ensure that it doesn't backfire?
Well, I think what we will work toward, we are already building much more robust, continuous measures of patient satisfaction, veteran satisfaction. And I think that becomes the single most important set of metrics that we use to gauge our success by. It's the success as viewed from the veteran's perspective.
Is there some benchmark for an appropriate wait time that you have in mind that would tell you we are hitting our target here, we are where we need to be?
One of the things that I've learned, I'm now at 6 months at the VA, one of the things that I've learned is you won't find large integrated healthcare systems that are using a single wait time metric as the basis for judging access to care, because there's no clinical relevance for a single wait time. For some veterans that need to be seen today, even the old 14-day standard failed miserably. And so basically that's why I think we get back to looking at veteran satisfaction, at patient satisfaction, so that we are asking the veteran, did we see you timely? Were you able to get that appointment scheduled when you wanted to be seen? And so for the veteran that doesn't need to be seen, doesn't care about being seen in 3 or 4 weeks, that's fine. For the veteran that needs to be seen today, we see that veteran today.
Sloan Gibson is the Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Thanks for the opportunity.
Every inch of that place, every grain of sand, wanted desperately to kill us. The author of that line is writing about Iraq, and he should know. He's a former Marine, Michael Petrie, who's written a compelling new novel about the Iraq War. The novel, titled Fives and 25s, is told in the voices of a Marine lieutenant, a medic, and their Iraqi interpreter. Michael Petrie joined the Marines after 9/11. He was a history and creative writing major at Louisiana State. He became an officer and served two tours in Iraq's Anbar province, not in combat. He was in logistics and communications. Pedestrian is how he describes his experiences there. But Petrie told me when he came back home, his wife pointed something out. She noticed he was telling decoy stories when friends asked about the war. Funny, innocuous stories to move the conversation along. And he was keeping the upsetting things secret.
And my wife telling me that made me feel bad. I felt like a coward. So my personal stories are actually pretty dull. I did not have an exciting, action-packed Iraq experience, but my close friends did, and I was there, and their stories weren't being told the way I thought they should.
Well, let's lay out the storyline of the unit that's at the heart of your novel. It's a road repair crew in Iraq and a bomb disposal team working with them. Talk a bit about their mission and how they do it.
Well, their mission is to fill potholes, to repair the roads and highways of western Iraq. The problem is the potholes are created by IEDs, roadside bombs, and the insurgent cells were planting IEDs in the same potholes over and over and over again. So when you would go out to repair the potholes, you had to first clear the bomb that was waiting for you. So it was just this endless grind of really brutal manual labor in a very dangerous environment. And if this was not my job, it was the job of a very close friend of mine named Ed Donahue. And I asked him the question, how many of those potholes had another bomb in them, Ed? And he said, oh, every single one.
One of the characters in your book, when he comes back from Iraq, is asked that question, you know, how many potholes did you fill? He says, 647. How many had a new bomb in them?
647.
Every single one, yeah.
Now, I wanted to tell a story that was... that didn't fetishize combat. It was a war story with very little real combat as we know it. Because war is work, right? It's sweaty and it's exhausting, and sometimes it's carrying bags of concrete in the 130-degree sun and wondering if you're just going to get engaged by a sniper when your back is turned. And it was not glamorous, and it's not SEAL Team 6. It's just work. And I wanted to tell a story about that.
Is that something you found in other war writing, that it does fetishize combat in a way that makes you really uncomfortable?
No, not. I mean, as long as there's context. The combat in Iraq, the fighting done by the Marines there, was not an end unto itself. We didn't go there to fight just to fight. The fighting was part of a larger military mission, and that military mission was the safety and security of the Iraqi people. That was the reason why I included a narrator who was Iraqi. It was really their war much more than it was ever ours, and I wanted their story told as well.
The Iraqi character whom you mentioned is the interpreter who's working with this road repair crew. He's known as a Terp for interpreter,
yeah.
And he's given the name Dodge.
Yes.
He's a young guy. He likes Metallica. He likes rap music. He was working on a thesis on Huck Finn back in Baghdad, and a lot of the story is told through his eyes. How hard was it for you to try to understand the war from his perspective and his conflicted perspective in the middle of it?
It took some thought and it took some soul searching. And I knew a number of interpreters, none of whom are direct inspirations for Dodge. He's really an invention. And putting myself in his shoes wasn't that hard, honestly, because you saw it every day on those guys' faces that they had to go home to this at the end of the day when you got to go home to sunny California.
I'm talking with Michael Petrie about his novel, Fives and 25s. Michael, I should have you explain the title, Fives and 25s, which refers to something specific that this team has to do.
Yeah, well, it's not just this team. It's any convoy that was on the road in Iraq or Afghanistan, for that matter. Fives and 25s refers to a tactic to maintain safe distances from possible roadside bombs. So if you were on a convoy and someone in the lead vehicle saw something suspicious that they needed to stop and investigate, the first thing everyone would do scanned 5 meters around the wheels of their Humvee to make sure that they weren't parked next to a bomb. So once everyone's clear in their fives, they dismount and do their 25-meter sweep, where they establish a larger zone of protection. But it also became a metaphor for protecting yourself. I heard it more than once in a Southern California bar. Two young Marines, one of them's too drunk, and his buddy says to him, "Hey, man, watch your fives and 25s," meaning, you know, stay safe.
You know, I wonder, as you were creating these characters, some of whom are deeply flawed, they're not necessarily what we might think of as heroes in the traditional sense, how tricky a balance that was for you to find, of wanting to portray the whole of the experience and not glamorize it, not sanitize it, but also you must have deep loyalty to the Marine Corps and how it's seen.
I do. And my loyalty to the Marine Corps and to those with whom I served, my loyalty to them led me to want to tell a true story. And as I was writing it, and this is, in all honesty, a manuscript I never thought would be read by anyone other than my wife, I sent it out to my old friends from my old battalion and said, "Hey, read this." And the subject line was always, "Read this and tell me if I've brought dishonor to our Corps." And no complaints from them, which is what matters to me most.
Mm. You do seem to reserve the bulk of the critical pen for the State Department and for contractors and for people who really put the Marines in harm's way in very tangible ways. But that seems to be where the true, not venom,
right,
but where the true exasperation comes out on the page.
There's no getting rid of that. That exasperation will last the rest of my life, I know. I mean, you were dealing with a whole Marine Corps that was marched into this area of desert without a plan at all. And then you see around you contractors and folks who are really profiteering, was what a lot of it was. And there's a line in the book in which Lieutenant Donovan says to Dodge, "Hey, I think we're going to remember this war as the last time we were disappointed by our parents." And I do hold to that. There was this sense in Iraq that, you know, your dad had taken you on a vacation and didn't bring gas money and you were stranded. So the Marines on the ground in Iraq did the best with what they had. But in the end, there was no real strategy. And that was a shameful way to treat the U.S. military and to the volunteers.
I'm really curious to hear what you think as you read about and hear about what's going on in Iraq now and the spread of ISIS and extremism, the territory that's been taken back. From your experience, well, how do you see that?
It's absolutely gutting if you think about it too long. And I have stayed up late at night watching the news, unable to sleep, thinking about, God, I've been in that town. I saw those people. And now that they're under the thumb of such brutality, when we told them to trust us, is truly gutting.
And what do you do with that?
You try to go to sleep. In my case, anyway. I'm long separated from the service. You call up your friends, you have a heart-to-heart, and you try to move on with your life.
I've been talking with Michael Petrie. His novel is Fives and 25s. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you've bought any steaks or hot dogs to throw on the grill lately, you may have noticed a higher price tag. The Department of Agriculture says pork and beef prices are up more than 11% since last summer. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer looks at what's going on with the price of meat from the farm to the table.
You probably learned this basic concept in school. Supply and demand determine price. Supply comes from places like this. Riley Lewis's hog farm near Forest City, Iowa. 1,000 acres of corn surround the barns here. A grain silo from 1948 is dwarfed by modern storage bins. When Lewis enters the barn, pigs trot over to greet him. Last December, a nasty new pig virus sickened animals here. Even worse, porcine epidemic diarrhea virus swept through nursery barns on farms where Lewis buys piglets.
We do buy our pigs from Illinois, and they come in at 12 to 13 pounds, and they did have a little shot of it that went through, and our numbers right now are down.
Across the country, the virus killed several million piglets, adding up to a lot fewer hogs at market. So tighter supply means Lewis gets paid more per pound per hog.
It's been remarkable what the price has done. The last couple of years, hog farmers dug a real deep equity hole. And so it's really nice to have that hole start to get filled up.
He's referring partly to the cost of feed, a major expense here on the farm. After record high corn prices in 2012, feed has now gotten cheaper. Lewis can raise bigger hogs. It's a different story with cattle, which take much longer to bring to market. When feed prices skyrocketed, many ranchers sold off more cattle than they might have otherwise. That extra beef's long gone, and ongoing drought in the Plains states means herds aren't growing fast enough to meet demand. But what about shoppers? At this Fairway grocery store in Ames, the meat counter is doing a brisk business, especially in chops, brats, and ham loaf.
Come in. Two of the America's Cut pork chop.
John Green, the National Pork Board's Director of Strategic Marketing, says stores are actually trying to protect consumers from even steeper prices.
Produce and meat are the two big things that pull people into a store. And so changing those prices, especially raising those prices, is one of the last things that a retailer really wants to do.
So even as grocers watch the price of cattle and hogs climb, they need to keep you coming in.
Some retailers just took that on the chin and had to be competitive in their marketplace. Others tried to make some money where they could, you know, to recoup that back. But by and large, they try to keep those prices stable.
They try lots of things to do that, even buying some cuts frozen. Still, there's a limit, and when it's reached, prices rise. But Iowa State University livestock economist Lee Schultz says climbing prices don't always scare away customers.
We've really seen higher and higher prices being pushed on to consumers. But overall, we've seen very robust demand for beef.
And so far, it's the same with pork. We keep buying it, even though it costs more. Shoppers who can may spend more to eat the same amount of meat. Others will spend just the same, but get less. And that can mean being more selective about which meat products we buy. The Pork Board's John Green says bacon remains a strong seller.
A little bit of bacon provides a tremendous amount of flavor, you know, and satisfaction. So you don't have to eat 8 ounces of bacon, a strip or two at breakfast, on a breakfast sandwich, on a salad. You know, all the different ways that bacon is now being used on, you know, a topping for a burger is really what's kind of driving it, I think.
And Green doesn't see any end in sight for Americans' fascination with bacon. With a record corn crop projected this fall, it's likely feed prices will continue falling, something that eventually could bring down meat prices. For NPR News, I'm Amy Mayer in Ames, Iowa.
That story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration that focuses on agriculture and food production.
It's been a long time since boxing has captured the American imagination. There was a time when Jack Dempsey or Jack Johnson or Joe Louis or Muhammad Ali dominated the sports scene. There is no equivalent star today. In case you've lost track, the world heavyweight scene has been dominated lately by two Ukrainian brothers, Vladimir and Vitaly Klitschko. Boxing promoters would like to see bigger stars, and some are looking to China for fresh talent. NPR's Nathan Rott met one of the latest imports.
And here we go, ladies and gentlemen, our first bout tonight.
In boxing, it's not often that the first fight of the night gets a whole lot of attention. But a few weeks ago at Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco, the fans in attendance, the announcers, even the casual viewers watching the broadcast on Fox Sports 1 were all captivated by the boxer in the blue corner.
Tonight, he makes his professional debut and joins us from Beijing, China. Here is the Great Wall,
At 6'11" and 285 pounds, Tyshawn, the Great Wall, doesn't need much of an introduction to get a room's attention. He has the stature of a comic book hero, and that bold-lettered kapow in his punch to back it up.
There's a right hand and he drops him right on the top of the head, and that's it.
By recording a knockout in his professional debut, 26-year-old Tyshawn Dong announced his arrival on the U.S. boxing scene.
He says his goal is to become the Yao Ming of boxing here in the United States.
That may be a little far-fetched for a guy who's only been boxing for a little more than a year. Yao Ming had been playing basketball full-time in China for nearly a decade before he made his U.S. debut, and Tyshawn knows a comparison's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, but,
a few weeks later, he refines that statement. He says the Yao Ming comparison is a compliment, but he wants to be known as Tyshawn. And Tyshawn's already off to a fast start of accomplishing that goal. He's got a fighting background in kung fu and kickboxing. He's already signed with Golden Boy Promotions, one of boxing's biggest promoters. And during his first day back at training, after the fight at the Glendale Fighting Club north of Los Angeles, he's already got a gaggle of photographers snapping away as he bounces in circles, slugging at a pad held by his trainer, John Bray. After 20 minutes, Bray is drenched in sweat.
You need ice?
Oh, man, you see it, huh, what I'm talking about?
Bray calls Tyshawn's punch a battering ram, and Bray's no small man himself. He's 6'3" and a little rounder than he was in his own day as a professional heavyweight, but you'd still give him your lunch money if he came asking. Outside, he wipes at his brow.
In your prime, you think you could have taken him?
No. Too big.
But Bray says it's more than just his sheer size. It's his desire. Tyshawn's real name is Jian Jundong. The name Tyshawn comes from Mount Tyshawn, the most famous of China's five sacred mountains. Outside of the gym, the boxer explains. A few years ago, I climbed to the top of Mount Tyshawn, he says. When I got to the top, I looked down and liked the feeling. I want to feel that way with boxing. The people around Tyshawn think that he can. His promoter, Bill Kaplan, says there's no other boxer like him.
No, he's unique. He's very unique.
There's never been a boxing promoter that didn't want to hype up a big, strong, undefeated heavyweight.
That's Dan Rayfield, a senior boxing writer at ESPN. Rayfield watched Tyshawn's debut fight, and he says he was impressed.
But this is a guy that did not have a particularly huge amateur background. He's 1-0 against the lowest possible level opponent that there is. So
he's still got a lot to prove. Now, that's not to say that Tyshawn doesn't have the potential, and the stage is certainly set. The reigning world heavyweight champ Vladimir Klitschko is 38 and said to be nearing retirement. Below him, there's no clear successor. That's got every promoter in the sport looking for the next big thing. And increasingly, they're looking at Chinese fighters. Promoter Dino Duva.
The professional boxing scene in China is by far the biggest growth area for the future, and it's going to really, really explode over the next couple of years.
Duva says that boxing's popularity in China has been soaring since Chinese boxers medaled in both the 2008 and 2012 Olympics.
I think that a Chinese heavyweight boxer can be as big as any Chinese athlete that there's ever been.
That's why Duva recently started Dynasty Boxing, a promoting company that focuses solely on Chinese fighters. His first heavyweight, Zhang Zhilei, recorded a KO in his debut earlier this month. By bringing Zhilei to America, Duva hopes to train him in a country with a rich boxing tradition and a fan base that's looking for heavyweights. Those are the same draws that brought Tyshawn here. Back at the gym, he says he looks forward to the challenges ahead. I will do my best in boxing, he says. I hope that all of these people continue to support me down the road. Tyshawn's next fight has yet to be scheduled, but he hopes it's sooner rather than later. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
And another major story in the news has set off a debate, in this case over censorship, and whether images are ever too graphic to be distributed by news outlets or shared by individuals on social media. We're talking here about the video showing the beheading of American journalist James Foley by Islamist militants. The New York Post was widely criticized for running a still image of the moment before Foley was killed on its front page. YouTube quickly removed the video after militants posted it. Twitter briefly suspended the accounts of those who shared it. Now, we tried to sort out some of these questions with Robert Hernandez. He's a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Journalism and Communication. And he draws a distinction between a news organization like the New York Post and a social media platform like Twitter.
From a journalist's perspective, I'm against censorship of any kind, right? As an American journalist, freedom of speech is the First Amendment. My job is covered by the First Amendment. And I don't want any government or industry to censor what I can and cannot say to my community in my attempts to ethically inform them. I do believe Twitter and others being proactive about censoring this information start to engage in a slippery slope. And they're framing themselves, at least with this particular case, as a proactive editor determining what is good or bad for their users. And that, again, for me as a journalist, makes me uncomfortable.
Let me just make sure I understand this, because it seems like a very important point. You're saying the New York Post, they are journalists. They made the decision on their own. You might say that it was a bad decision, but it was a news organization, a publisher, so to speak, making a decision about what to publish. Twitter, in the eyes of many of us, you know, is a platform for us to share, and that's a different thing for them to censor you or I or other people in terms of what we want to share or not.
Yeah, I would look at it as if the printing press operators decided that they wanted to censor the New York Post, right? That's if we view Twitter as a platform. Printing press operators wouldn't shape a newspaper. Those that are running the antennas for radio stations and satellites, they're not censoring or editing our content.
Some have suggested that by allowing this video to be available, it is helping ISIS, these militants, spread their propaganda. What do you make of the argument someone would say that might hurt people if we're allowing this group to get their propaganda, you know, wider reach?
The reality is these organizations are really sophisticated with their propaganda, and this is just one video of many different types of strategies that they employ. And that's one group, and there are other groups domestically, from militias to neo-Nazis, that are also creating content and putting it out there in the world. Viewing a video, I feel like you need to make that decision. You need to make that decision. The government shouldn't make that decision for you. A tech company shouldn't make it for you. Even if I was running the New York Post and I chose not to put that on the front page, you as a member of the community have the freedom to go Google it and look it up yourself. But for me to block you from it, to me, at least as a journalist, I think that's wrong.
Let me ask you, I mean, in the United States, the government regulates child pornography on the internet, for example. I mean, is that a dangerous slippery slope?
Well, now we're going to go into different gray areas, and everything could be a slippery slope depending on where you draw a line. I can only draw my own line, and I think that child pornography is different from the things of war. Let me give you an example. If we were to have a technology company censoring images from the Vietnam War, think of the iconic images that would be censored and blanked, and these are the images that changed the tone, the country, the direction of that war. I think of the iconic image of the nude young girl running and crying away from a scene. What would we classify that as? Would we censor that because someone would be offended by it? I, as a journalist, want to make that decision. I mean, the law is not blanket free speech. Hate speech and certain types of speech have been blocked. This one here is not the government censoring. This is a tech company that is censoring. Now, again, it's their platform and their rules, but it is something to be aware of. It's something different.
Professor Hernandez, thanks so much for joining us on the program. We appreciate you talking about this.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Hernandez teaches at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Journalism and Communication.